If you are a regular listener to this podcast, then you know that for the past 7 months, a lot of the episodes have focused on my new book, I've Got Something to Say, out on Feral House Books. I've talked to the illustrators who contributed to the book, Gary Dumm, Gary Texalli, Mary Fleener, Valiant himself, Juan Montoya, Fiona Smith, Away from Voivod, Brian Walsby. While over on Instagram, people who have purchased the book have sent me kind feedback. Some have even taken selfies holding the book or just the cover of the book. Every time someone sends me a photo, I screenshot it and save it because I love seeing them. Overall, I must say that response has been pretty much 100% positive, something I wasn't expecting on the eve of the book's release. My nervousness to release the book exceeded my usual excitement slash nervousness when releasing an album. With this book, I was a lot more vulnerable, and these days people have a tendency to be nasty online, or at least blasé with the comments they leave. And still, it's been nothing but supportive and enthusiastic. So if you have bought a copy of the book, have read the book, or have even reached out to me with your response of it, I am very thankful and grateful for it. Now that there's been enough time for people to read it, it's not a long read at all. Some people are reaching out to me, and one of the most fun emails I got about the book was from Marty Friedman. Marty sent me an email saying he read the book, loved the book, and now wanted to debate me on an essay I wrote contained in it called Kerry King Made Me Do It, all about guitar picks and my stance on guitar picks. Now, knowing Marty Friedman is considered one of the best, if not the best, metal guitar player in the world, I was delighted to argue Marty on this. If there's anyone who is an expert on guitar picks, it's Marty Friedman. But I held my stance. And this is really what the book is about. Essays that were meant to spark debate, or essays sparked from jovial debate in dressing rooms, van rides, bus lounges, airport gates, or at festival catering. Just rockers talking about rock and reveling in the different points of view. We did it when we were 14. We still do it to this day. Sometimes they get heated, but that's when it gets good. Before that, however, with my natural curiosity on all things Marty Friedman, I had to ask what he's been up to as well. Getting to sing on three tracks off his 2014 album Inferno, I will forever be tied to Marty. But before all that, I was always a big fan of Cacophony and, of course, his time in Megadeth. In 2017, he released Wall of Sound and followed it up with his new live album, One Bad MF Live. Super proof of Marty's guitar prowess, if there ever needed to be. This is his fourth time on the podcast. He's already a member of the Black Coffee Brigade. The Black Coffee Brigade is a group made up of people who have been on the podcast three times or more. Usually, Marty jumps on here to talk about our mutual love of Kiss and our mutual interest in talking about Kiss and any recent Kiss happenings. It's been a while since he was last on here, so we talked about other things. Living in Japan, so far away from us here in North America, I'm just glad Marty is putting out records and touring over here more these days. The world of heavy music needs him over here. I want to say a big thank you to everyone who has left cool feedback on this podcast in the iTunes stores. And in case you didn't know, the podcast is now available to be streamed on Spotify as well. Okay, here we go. Marty Friedman returns to the podcast. He is this episode's guest on the official Danko Jones podcast, and it starts now. The Danko Jones podcast is the best around. Nick Flynn, Guinness, Danko's go out to love for free. I'm so glad I like you sometimes. Jimmy in from fucked up. Stop playing. Hang down, down. Thank you for listening to the Danko Jones podcast, you motherfuckers! It's fucking great! It fucking slays! Thank you for listening to the Danko Jones podcast, you motherfuckers!
Michael Jones Podcast, with a finger on the pulse of what's going on culturally in the world. Wait a second. That's not his finger.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, get ready because the Danko Jones Podcast starts. No!
Hello, Marty.
What's going on, man?
Hey, how you doing, man?
Pretty good. How about yourself?
Good, good. Good morning.
All right. Good morning, man. Good afternoon.
Yeah. Yeah, sometimes the time zone really throws me off between Toronto and Tokyo.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So
what is it? Evening by you guys?
Yeah, it's 9 p.m. here.
Oh, cool. It's 11 in the morning.
Yeah.
It's all good.
Yeah. So, man, it was great to get that email from you that you had read my book and you enjoyed it, and I was flattered. So thanks a lot for picking it up and reading it and giving it a read.
Dude, it was fantastic. I really, really enjoyed it. And just so many things that I just connected with. It was like so many things in common. And I just was like chuckling to myself. It's like, dude's reading my mind. And I've got the book in front of me right now. And when I saw the title that said "Musicians Talking Dante's Nine Circles of Hell," there could not be anything more boring than two musicians talking.
Oh my God!
And yeah, I just love that title. And then I think what you wrote about was a little bit different than what I expected it to be, but it's still totally got it, and just so many insights that I could totally relate to, and I'm sure that so many people could like relate to so many things, but never really had someone come out and say it, you know what I mean?
Well, thanks a lot for that. I mean, there was a few KISS-centric essays that were put in there for you know, people who are digging KISS. So the solo album one and the color theory stuff, just like super nerdy stuff that isn't even really nerdy, because it's just an idea that I kind of shoveled a lot of BS on top of. And
yeah, well, that's what makes it good, man. It's really, I really got a big kick out of so much of this stuff. Really, congratulations. A lot of people are digging it, I'm sure.
Yeah. It's it was put out by Feral House, and that's the same book company that have put out a few popular music titles, like Lords of Chaos, which is now a movie about the black metal scene in Norway, Choosing Death, the history of death metal. But they also do like occult books and I don't want to say conspiracy books, but really outside of the box type of book. When they do delve into the music side of things, it's really cool. Like the Yahuwah 13, the brother Zod, the Source cult / band / religion book. And yeah, just all kinds of crazy, crazy ideas and crazy books. And the founder is Adam Parfrey, who passed away earlier this year, but he wrote Apocalypse Culture, and that kind of sets the tone for the whole imprint. So I'm just flattered that they, you know, put out my book. I've been reading their titles for God, so much, since I was like in high school, like finishing high school. So yeah, it's great to be aligned with them, because it's great. Yeah, I'm just happy about it. And then to get an email from you that you had read the book and you enjoyed it, that is what I was hoping for like the 2 years that we worked on the book, to get an email like the one you sent me. That would be the final stamp of the whole process. Like, that's what you're gunning for. So that was, yeah, it really meant a lot. So thanks a lot for that.
Oh, you're welcome. I just really, really dug it. So many great points. And I was kind of surprised to note how incredibly knowledgeable you are about the genre of metal, and kind of ashamed to say that I'm not like maybe even a tenth of as knowledgeable as you are with all the details and all the bands and all the songs and all the titles. And it really kind of, well, wow, I don't really know anybody who's this knowledgeable, and it's really cool. Usually guys who are this knowledgeable aren't actually making music themselves. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, I just love it. I mean, you know, you and I share a fandom for Kiss, and Kiss was the band that really got me to love it all. Like, yeah. Really go, like, take the deep dive and just immerse yourself in this world that they right. kind of created. And it's funny that we're talking together because they just recently announced the, well, in air quotes, their end of the road farewell tour. I think the whole Kiss Army's kind of, I don't know. I think it really is the end, but it is 3 years. It's a 3 year long tour, but Kiss are the band that really got me to be as an extreme a fan as I guess I am. I don't really think of myself as I'm, you know, as I'm getting older, I'm realizing that I'm saying out loud more like, who's this? Like, who's this band? Like, when it's being played on the stereo, I'm starting to lose a grasp of the edge, if you know what I mean.
Well, you know, when you have a career yourself, you can't always put the same amount of energy into knowing all the minutia of, you know, band names and song names and credits and stuff like you do when you're a kid, you know, like everything, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's, but now, I mean, when I do find a band that I really like, that's new, I latch onto them so hard because I'm trying to recapture how I did it when I was a kid, how much I latched onto them. So I like if there's a new band I like, I really like them, but sometimes I feel like I have to take an extra step just to feel that enthusiasm. Like, I want to feel that youthful enthusiasm like I did. But the one thing I noticed that you were, you did the Jamie Jasta podcast recently, and there was a discussion, and it was great, by the way. And the discussion you guys had that really held my attention the most was how the two of you were talking about there's no such thing as a guilty pleasure. And that's something that, I mean, I wasn't surprised to hear you say that, because anyone who knows your background, your discography, and knowing you, you know, personally over the years now, your musical tastes are so wide and varied. It wasn't surprising that you guys went down, you started talking about Careless Whisper, because I love that album. I love Wham. I love Wham's first two albums. So, you know, I get it, you know. And there's even an article in the book called, like, there's no such thing as a guilty pleasure. And so, yeah, I get it. I get it.
Well, I think that's maybe coming a little bit more into vogue nowadays than it was when you and I were both kids. I mean, it would be a lot harder to admit that type of thing if we weren't both playing music for a living. You know what I mean? If we were just like kids in high school and your friends are all hanging out listening to Sabbath or whatever the heavy thing was at the time, and then suddenly you say, well, actually, I like this, 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 and this. You know what I mean? It's a lot different now for us than it was when we were like 15 and 16, when that shit really, really mattered. You know what I mean? And I think so. Hopefully, you know, that trend will kind of, I don't know, man, it's kind of hard to say. You know, there's something about, I don't know what it's like for kids now, but there's just something about being part of a group that we all love this super heavy music, and we're really true to this group of heavy music. And if we liked some other kind of music, we kind of keep it to ourselves, or, you know, only let our girlfriends know about it or something like that. You know, that's, I guess that's normal for being a kid, you know, but like once you're, especially when you're playing music for a living and you play a lot of things that require the finesse of knowing how a lot of other kinds of music are made,
yeah,
then you know, it's really, there's no shame in saying it, that you like this, 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 and this at that point. But I don't think a lot of 15-year-olds have that kind of self-confidence to like stand up to their buddies and say that they like something that goes against the group of friends, you know.
I agree. I mean, I didn't. I stuck to heavy metal and rock and roll or hard rock or whatever. That was my bag growing up. And I, sure, you know, I went to school where there was a lot of preppies and people were into Depeche Mode and all this stuff. And they made fun of me because I was really in the minority. But I quietly liked some of those Depeche Mode songs, you know. and I bet they liked some of that metal that they would maybe see on TV, if not hear on the radio. So, right. Yeah, like, it's, I don't know. I don't know what to think, because in a way, I kind of miss how much of a gang and a group it was and how much of a clubhouse it kind of was. And now that everybody's kind of, you know, there's no real dividing lines, which is great in some respects, in a lot of respects. But yeah, I miss that kind of us against them.
Yeah, I think I totally agree with you. I think what we really are missing, though, is that feeling of us against them. But it only really feels good if you're like 15 or 16 and like cutting class to like smoke a joint. That's when that stuff is just so cool. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That stuff when you're like 30, it's just like, it's kind of lame. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just kind of lame. So I think what we both are nostalgic about is those times when you're like 15 and 16, because, you know, let's face it, that's the best. I mean, that's the best there is. You're discovering all the great things that are about to come and happen to you. And it's just a really great period of time. Even if it sucked at the time, it was still a great period of time.
Yeah, no, it's so true. It's so true. And I remember when I was, you know, 15, 16, and back then, for me, it was like, you know, the glam rockers against the thrashers, or the punk rockers against the heavy metal guys. And I quietly liked it all. I liked it all. You know, I loved, and you can laugh at me, but I to this day, I still love Look What the Cat Dragged In by Poison's first album.
Oh, are you kidding? That's great.
It's great. Yeah, such a great album. So, oh, yeah.
Who knew?
But I didn't tell a soul. And I had the album. I didn't tell a soul. But yeah, no, it's cool. But you are about a week or two into the release of your new album, a live album.
Right.
It's called One Bad MF Live.
Right.
And it's a double album, double live album. Now, did you take your cue from Kiss putting it out as a double album? That's the first thought that came to my head. Oh, that's what Marty's doing.
Well, in a lot of respects. I mean, I think Kiss's two live albums are, and the albums that are in between those two live albums are just such a stamp on the history of music and influenced so many people that have made important contributions to music in the world that it can't be overstated, that whole thing. And so when it came time to do a live album, of course I wanted some of the things that are on those two live albums, mainly being a fold out so you can clean the stems and seeds of your pot in the middle of it. And then now that the pot's legal everywhere, I find out that they don't have stems and seeds anymore. So it was all for nothing.
Right.
But I wanted that in there. And if you look at the back cover of the album, it's got four squares, just like Kiss Alive 2.
Mm-hmm.
Has that type of thing.
Nice.
And you know, just the basic feel of the performance. I mean, everybody has solos on the record. You know, if you see, oh, it's Marty Friedman, you might think it's just one guitar player, you know, soloing out. But my thing is, just, it's a band. It's so much like a band that on the album you can really see. I mean, everyone quite outshines me, to be honest. And there's, you know, drum solo, bass solo, other guy guitar solo, and I'm soloing all over the place. And it's really a wild, intense night all over. But I mean, it's a very equal band type of feeling, and it's kind of an old school live album feeling. I was definitely going for that. You know, the audience is definitely a cast in the cast of characters on the record. I mean, they play a big part in the record, and they do a lot of participation with us and singing along, even though there's no words, and and they're just doing a lot of great audience stuff. And I just remember as a kid, you know, we didn't have DVDs to actually watch the concerts. When we listened to the live album, your imagination just takes you to this place, this venue, that all kinds of crazy shit's going on in there, and bombs are going off, and everybody's just having a wild time in there, and you're just, imagination runs wild. And I wanted that feeling on the record. So, you know, our performance was 2 hours. So to put that into two albums, that has to be like about 70, 78 minutes or so to fit on CD. So I really edited it in a fashion that made it feel like the big live albums that you and I both grew up with. You know, the Kiss ones, of course, the Ramones, UFO Live, Foghat, Blue Oyster Cult, all of those great live albums had this pacing about it that I really recreated, and I'm really happy with the way it came out, and especially with vinyl coming back, which you also mentioned in your book. I think that is a super way to really enjoy a live album. You know, you play it on the vinyl, and you look at the big pictures, and you read the big liner notes, and you just have something to do while you're imagining what's going on in this venue. So I kind of wanted that experience again in something that I released, and I wanted a document of how cool I think my band is at this point. And, you know, that's basically what it was. It's the very typical show on tour. So it came out really good.
Now, was the album culled from more than one performance?
No, it's just one show straight down.
That's, that's amazing.
Put it up and rocked it. And the only songs I really cut out were songs that were on a previous live album that I did in 2007. And in almost Kiss fashion, you know, when they did Kiss Alive 2, they didn't put any of the songs that were already released on Kiss Alive 1.
Right.
So I didn't want to repeat too much. There's like maybe two songs that were on the first live album, but the pace of the live show was the top priority. You know, it was just one. It was one show in Mexico City, and you know, I knew that like if we had a problem in a song, that I planned to stop and do the song again and tell the audience, you know, we're doing a live album, so we had to do the song again. But it didn't happen. It was just a show just went by completely normal, and a lot of good happy accidents in there. You know, everything is not perfectly accurate or anything like that, and we don't even play with a click on most of the songs, so a lot of things were crazy.
It's a perfect performance as a live album goes. Having put out a couple of live albums myself, and in the past having sworn to never do that, and then putting out two live DVDs as well, going into the recording of these things, is you get in, at least for me, I get into a mindset that I don't think a lot of people really experience, even if you're a musician, knowing that this next show is going to be forever, and you know, basically zero fuck ups. And so that really plays on with my head. And I try to, like, you know, kind of in the last second just go, forget it, let's just go out, and who cares what happens.
Right. Well, that's exactly when it happens. It's the last second, or actually the first second. The first second you start playing, you're like, oh, well, this is what I've been doing every day for the last X number of weeks.
Right.
I'll just do it again. And then about halfway through the first song, you forget that it's anything different than any other show. And I was really more concerned about like any kind of equipment failure that might possibly mar a otherwise really good performance. That would have been, I'd rather like leave a halfway, not a perfect performance. I'd rather leave a kind of bad performance on tape than have an awesome performance that gets ruined and can't go there at all. That would really piss me off. Yeah, if that makes any sense, you know, sometimes like you're just having these godlike performances and for whatever reason that doesn't get used or it gets erased or something like that would piss me off more than having a less than perfect performance that goes out.
It's kind of
stupid sounding, but, you know, I really, because sometimes magic happens and you really love that one moment, and for that moment not to actually make it to people's ears, that really, really, really grates on you.
I think that's the punk rock in you, being okay with that. You know.
Yeah, I mean, unless it's like a serious train wreck, you know, which can happen. You know, our music has got a lot of twists and turns in it, but unless it's a serious train wreck. Usually I'm completely fine with any little inaccuracies, and sometimes the inaccuracies are better than what I was intending to do in the first place. So I'm cool with that, but just, I really hate when there's a technical difficulty that prevents something cool that was about to happen. That gets my goat. And that happens in the actual recording studio sometimes too. Mm. You know, if there's an assistant who doesn't have you in record. You know. We've all got those stories.
I just laid the solo of my life.
It happens. You know that, but if that happened enough in my early part of my career, that I actually developed the ability to do anything again. If I've done it once, I can do it again. So this is it's really important, I think, for anyone to know that they are able to do that. Sometimes there are nuances of what you do that there's no way you could ever do it again, but at least you can repeat what you just played again, even if it's weird and unorthodox. So that is something luckily I developed in an early age, but sometimes like when the magic gets killed because of somebody's fuck up, then you're really pissed.
You know, on one of our last live album we put out, I think about 3-4 years ago, from Vakken Open Air, they put out a live DVD with a live album on vinyl, double album, like you were mentioning. But there's a couple of songs where I basically forgot the lyrics, and it's there forever. It's there forever, and I volley back and forth whenever I heard it recently, and it was so cringeworthy. It was like torture. But
did you say the wrong lyrics, or you just skipped out lyrics altogether?
I basically forgot the verse. You can hear it. I forgot the verse, and so what I started to do is just nonsense vocables that kept with the time and the rhythm, you know, and. Usually at a show, it happens at least once or twice every show we ever play, but it's not part of the show. I know, but I walked off stage just going, it wasn't the best show. It was 7 out of 10 for me. And I just wish they caught a 9 out of 10 show at least. You know? So, it is what it is, but you just got to live with. Yeah. So, I mean, it's a snapshot, if anything.
That's a good point, though. With the 7 out of 10 thing, because I always, always feel that it's a 7 out of 10. It always is. I always know that I could have done much, much better, and it always is 7 out of 10. It's not like there's nines and there's fours, and I think the only time when it's a 10 out of 10 is like rare times in the studio when just for whatever reason. Things are just happening. But I think the key to that is to keep yourself so in tune with what you're doing and so in shape, so to speak, with what you're going to do and well rehearsed and all juiced up and ready to go, that even your 7 out of 10 is pretty damn good.
And right.
Because right. if you think, oh, if I'm not at a 9 or a 10, then I'm just going to mope around and be pissed off at myself. That's not good. But I think the good thing is to be just so well oiled machine that even your 7 or even a 6 is fucking amazing.
Right.
And that's what I try to do, because you can't kick yourself all the time for not, because it's really rare to be your ultimate best all the time. Don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, those shows happen. I mean, I've given myself 9 out of 10 and 10 out of 10 in the past, but they don't happen very often. They don't happen at every show.
And then if you do that still, when someone's going to come up to you after a really shitty show and say, dude, it was the best show of my life. I've never seen anything. They just, you know, blow so much sunshine up your skirt. They really legitimately loved the show. And to me inside, I'm like, fuck, didn't you hear the third song? Like completely, where the fuck were you? There was like no guitar in them. It was in the monitors. It sucked. But you can't say that. But then, no. Then you have what you think is like, this is the best show of my career. And then you go out and you're meeting people and you know, I saw you in Stockholm. It was a better show. It was very lackluster tonight. There's something. Yeah. So like, there's no point in judging yourself too much about all this stuff.
There was a one show I really remember, like, I think we played it last year, and it was a great show. I can't remember where, but I walked off going, that was a good show. And our tour manager came backstage and he goes, good show, boys. And I just felt like going, that's, you're damn right, that was a good show. Yeah. So yeah, there's some nights where everything just locks up and, you know, everybody. Yeah, but you're right. And also, I've learned over the years that if someone does come up to you and say that it's a great show tonight and you don't agree in your head, you can't say anything. You have to just.
Absolutely not. Like, you're going to crush the guy for life.
Yeah, yeah.
You can't. And kids remember that kind of stuff. Yeah. Everything you do. You know, you got to be nice. You got to just be nice.
Oh, yeah. It took me a couple of years to realize that, like, no, that's not what they're thinking. They're not alongside you in your mind along for this ride. They're on their own ride.
It's different things that make the show good for people, you know. It's like a lot of the things leading up to the show, you know, their girlfriend bought him the ticket or whatever, got his first blowjob in the car on the way to the show. Right. There's a lot of other things that make the whole night really good, and it really doesn't involve whether or not you could hear yourself in the monitor and you were a little bit out of tune for the first half of the set. Those aren't like the factors in that guy's good show.
Yeah, it's true. No. Everyone's living their own show, you know, so to
totally,
speak.
Totally, totally. You can't even get involved. Just like be happy for them and go on with the day.
And then the opposite happens where, yeah, you're like you're saying, like they do critique what you thought was the best show of the tour. Yeah. And you know, they're on their own trip. I don't know.
I know that I remember that happening one time. I just thought it was the best show ever, and some dude was complaining about something. I'm like, I finished this. Okay, now I'm going to go out and have people blow sunshine on my skirt because this show is great. And I'll agree with them. Honestly, agree with them. You know, fucking Sweden was a good show, but tonight, something, you're missing something. You know? Oh, the fuck is wrong with you? But if they honestly felt that way, then I'm totally into hearing it, actually.
Hmm.
And I actually prefer to hear, like, honest criticism. Like, I really felt that, you know, your bass player wasn't loud enough or whatever it is they felt. I'm way more interested in hearing that than just the random, oh, it was great. You know, I'm really interested in those honest opinions, and I'm really interested in what they have to say on that type of thing, and it's so appreciated. I was about to say something of value, and it just totally slipped out, but I think, am I making sense? This whole thing could be cut out. I'm about to say something that really matters, and then it didn't didn't come out.
No, it's okay.
Sometimes when I'm speaking English again, it's weird. It's weird. I talk this stuff in English very much.
Yeah, I have to remember that every time I talk to you, that you are immersed in Japan. I mean, that's, and then you're
I just finished a radio interview in Japanese. I'm going to do another thing right after this. So sandwiched in between completely unrelated stuff is me talking normal, cool stuff with you. So it's kind of thrown me for a loop, but, well, dude, check it out. I want to make sure that we get this topic in there. I want to talk about guitar picks. I read your reading. Whoever's listening to this, you got to get this book, because there's just so many things that will interest you, especially if you're listening to this podcast. You're just going to be blown away at how many cool things this book has in it. But in like 99.9%, I was like, I totally agree. The only two things that I didn't agree with, and maybe we'll get to the other one, is the Sabbath thing. But I definitely want to talk about that. But I definitely want to talk about guitar picks, because I was actually surprised at your stance on the issue. Mm-hmm. I was totally with you, because I do the exact same thing. I have a guitar pick collection, but I don't collect religiously. And oftentimes, if I'm in a studio, there's like picks around, and it's like, oh, this dude's picks here. I'll like pick it up and keep it.
Yeah.
And I have like a ton of picks like that, or like at gigs or techs will like, you know, have them on my amp. I'm like, that's not my pick. And I'm like, oh, I'll just take it. And so I wind up with tons of picks. And so I've collected them like that, but it's not like I've tried to collect them. But if there's something cool in front of me, I'll keep it. So it sounds like exactly like what you've done.
Yeah, exactly.
So like we're like exactly on the same page there. But then like you said something about not throwing out picks during the show because people, they don't wind up getting them, or they fall on the ground, or they don't go to the intended person. I'd like you to elaborate on that, and then I'll chime in with my thing, because I just thought it was cracking me up. It was just cracking me up.
Well, I've always found it ridiculous how the guitar player in the band will throw out a pick in the crowd, and sometimes we're talking festival arena sized shows, and you're supposed to find this needle in a haystack. Like I'm supposed to go for this pick you're throwing. Like,
it's, fuck yes.
It's
oh yes, you're supposed to go for that pick, dude.
No, man, because that that's so small. It's such a small little item. It's like throwing a grain of rice.
But I would have thought you, of all people, would think that if you actually got that pick, it's like the holy grail. I mean, if you're at like one of your favorite concerts, like you're at like Kiss in 77, and there's a pick that even goes anywhere remotely near you, that you're gonna like just barrel through all the people in the audience to get that pick.
I already know I'm never gonna get it.
Wow, my God, I'm totally blown away.
Yeah, and because
I'm totally blown away.
Also, remember, I think we have a tendency in our mind's eye to think that the lights are on. The lights are off at the show.
Yeah, the lights.
You were talking total darkness. Are you expecting me to believe that I'm going to find this tiny little penny-sized pick in complete darkness with thousands of other frothing fans?
It happens, though, all the time. People come up and say, dude, I caught your pick at this show. I caught your pick at that show. Sometimes it doesn't fall on the floor. You know, sometimes it'll hit a guy. One time it hit a guy in the forehead and it stuck to his forehead. He didn't know it was there. So we're in the pan watching this dude with this black pick in the middle of his forehead. And we were just dying. It's like, dude, you got a pick. You got a pick. He doesn't even notice it.
Well, sometimes
the dudes will actually catch the pick. Or sometimes you'll throw out, like Paul Stanley used to throw out like loads of picks, or Rick Nielsen would just throw out like 50 picks at once. And
yeah,
like,
I'm behind that. I get that.
You're behind that.
Yeah.
I'm cool with that. But dude, another thing, the thing about throwing the picks out and it's not necessarily about whether anybody catches it or not, is how cool does it look when the guitar player wings a pick like X number of feet or meters or far, like it's like this Japanese shuriken or something. It's just like wings over the audience at high speed. And like it's just like this outer space type of thing. I mean, don't you think that's cool?
Yeah, but it never happens.
Dude, oh my God. Let me tell you, the first time I've thrown out my pick since I was like 14. But then one time I did, I think I was with Megadeth at the time. We did a festival with Joan Jett, and the guitar player in her band threw his pick. I saw this pick all the way from the stage to like the whole other end of the arena. I could see the thing fly all the way out. I'm like, oh my God, this guy's a master. And he was just winging these picks fast and far. I'm like, dude, I got to get like that. So like, I got pretty decent, nowhere near as good as that guy. That guy was just, I never seen anything like it, but it looks cool to like wing a pick really far. And the farther you wing it, the more of a chance is that more people see it and somebody's going to catch it.
Okay, I'm going to give you the flip side to that, and I say it in the essay, but isn't it cooler for the person playing, the performer, to hand it to you with my own hands into your hands? Like it's
during the show, yes. During the show, yes, but not during the show. Don't you agree that it'd be cooler to receive something that was actually being played in the show?
Well, I always have like a bunch of, when I'm on the whole tour, even when I'm at home, I always keep at least 2 to 3 picks, if not 8, in my back, in my right back pocket. So I always have them. They're always there. And when I'm doing laundry, I have to like some of them, you know what I mean? So if someone is always coming up to me asking for a pick, I give it to them personally. I this is for you. This is, I don't give them the whole ramble, but I go, here you go. Like, there you go. It's like, that's,
I'll buy that.
That exchange, that's cool. It's one-on-one. It's like this. And then I go, sometimes I go, oh, I use this. So you can't really see the logo on it. It's been rubbed off. That's real.
That's real. That's total. I totally get it. It's like real. What do you call it? It's real organic, and it's super nice, super fan service. And I agree that is super important. But I would think, for me as a fan, the Holy Grail, it'd be like catching a foul ball at a game, you know what I mean? Actually, you saw the guy playing a song, and then he threw the pick, and you got that pick. Just as a fan at that actual show.
But it would take 2,000 picks to make a big enough object, like a baseball.
That's why it's so valuable. That's why it's so valuable treasured. But I used to remember with Kiss, I mean, they would just toss him out constantly. I mean, especially Paul, because he's barely playing. You know, he's just kind of, you know, just playing the chords once, and the other guy plays the other chords. But I love that as a showman, because there's so many souvenirs, and often he'll like throw them out like just to the barely in the front row. So like you can see, if you're right there, you can see that he's like about to throw a pick and kind of nicely lob it your way and not like wing it out in the middle of nowhere. But I just always loved watching like Rick Nielsen throw out loads of picks, and it's just like raining picks in there. And just as a fan, I just thought it looked cool, whether or not I got one or not. You know, I've never caught a pick in an audience. Like you said, it's like needle in the haystack, but like guys do it, and like pick guys really do it. I mean, the pick collectors. I just was surprised that you thought it wasn't cool to throw them out at the concerts. Cause I would have thought you would be the guy that I would be thinking is throwing them out in the concerts.
Well, these essays end up being written because it's the end of a rant that I've really gone off on. Yeah. And so I don't remember the moment, but I'm pretty sure it was like at a show and someone kept asking me to toss them a pick. And then I probably got off stage and I just go, why? I'm not going to toss them a pick. They're not going to catch it. And then I go,
you gave me a very good point. these are the guys who you don't want to throw a pick to. The guys that are saying, give me a pick, give me a pick. And they've got signs, throw me a pick, and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah. That really is like, man, what are you here for?
That dams up your runway, man.
Yeah.
So, like, but you want to, you would have given that guy a pick. You would have given that guy a pick had he not asked for a pick.
Oh, yeah. Like, I mean, you know, when we're, you know, moseying around the club during the day and it happens in Spain a lot, of all places, but they show up with their collection at soundcheck and they go, do you have a pick? Of course, I got to give that guy a pick.
Yeah, these guys are the best guys in the world. These guys, I'd love to give them picks.
Yeah.
And my tech will have picks from other tours and shit. So I'm like, talk to that guy and he'll give you even better picks and stuff. And these are the ultimate guys.
Yeah.
But the guys in the front, like with the sign, well, it's, you know, it's all in love, you know, so you love these guys too. They're there. They want it. But like, they don't realize that you're trying to play a song. You're trying to like entertain other people, and having a sign in your face kind of makes you want to go on a rant like you did. So I totally, totally get it.
Yeah. Like, and I just think that, would you appreciate a Rick Nielsen pick that was thrown with 100 other picks, or,
oh, yes.
Or
oh,
yes. Would you appreciate like Rick Nielsen giving you a blank pick that no one will ever believe it's a cheap trick pick, but he hand delivered it to you? Which one would you pick?
I would take the one in the concert. That was another good section of your book. You had great questions like this. And, you had great questions like this. They were like, what do you call them?
There's
a word in Japanese for it, but I don't know it in English. Like, not Aesop's fables, but like moral questions. I think I would go, that kind of confetti of picks, if I were to get one from there, I would have had goosebumps getting that thing.
Really? So like, if you, Rick, you would get one and then you can show all your friends, like, I was there, I caught this. It's got his face on it. It's got Cheap Trick on it. But then I show up and I go, he gave this to me personally. And he said, yeah.
See, like, this is what 2 15-year-olds would be arguing about. I love it.
I would take the blank pick. And to prove it, we recorded an album at Dave Grohl's studio, 606, years ago.
Yeah. That's where I did my last album, Wall of Sound. Great place.
Oh, amazing. I mean, it's amazing. And I love the neighborhood. I love it. It was great. Yep. It's such a great little studio. And you can really kind of zone in as well. It's really nice. But on the, we had to take a break during the session because the Foos had to rehearse. And that was cool by us because long story, but it was cool. When they were finished practicing, I found one of his picks on the floor, but it was used, so you could only barely, there was no Foo Fighters, there's nothing. You could just see, like, I think it was a cat on the guitar pick, but
right.
I used that to record successive albums, like the albums we did later.
That pick,
I used it because it was, I always use bass picks to play. And so sometimes when you need a little bit of finesse, you need that light, you know, that light pick to get in there. So I was like, I've got the pick. So I would always bring it to this album we just finished is the first album that I didn't use the pick. And I go, I forgot the pick.
You still have the pick?
I still have the pick. But no one would believe me if I said, this is Grohl's pick. So not that Grohl is anyone to like, you know, but it was cool that I found it on the floor and, you know, he was in Nirvana. So it was kind of cool.
Oh, Grohl is a god, man. I would have used that pick for sure.
Yeah.
I have the exact same story, dude. I was recording the album Rust in Peace and Mike Klink was producing.
Oh, yeah.
And he had just finished Guns N' Roses.
Right.
And I was having trouble on one of the rhythm guitar parts. They're really quite tricky. I was having trouble with it. And I saw a Slash guitar pick, you know, on the console. I'm like, oh, let me try this pick. Nailed the thing in one take with Slash's pick. And so it's the exact same story. It's the exact same story that you just told me. It was something that was there from a previous session.
Yeah.
And the mojo is somehow, you know, because you and I were both fans, you know, I mean, that stuff means something to us. You know, whether or not it's who our absolute hero is or not, it's still irrelevant. It's people that we respect and
yes.
we admire and we hopefully will get a little bit of magic from it. And
yes,
lo and behold, the magic comes sometimes.
Yes, that's definitely, that's what, I guess that was the bigger picture or what I was trying to relate in the essay as well. It's like, yeah, it's not about trying to catch the pick. It's about just in, I don't know what kind of moral I was trying to pass on, but yeah, that was.
No, basic. I mean, it's a totally a valid point, It's, I just thought it was so funny that our opinions differ on it because we were so in line up until that point in the article. I'm like, oh, he took it to a left turn. I'm like, but that's cool. I mean, everybody has a different opinion, which is absolutely makes things more fun. Gave us something to talk about.
Oh yeah, definitely. There's someone in our camp and he always gives me picks with all the bands he works with. He'll come back and he'll give me a bag of picks. And when I told him about this essay I was writing, he did not agree. He was very annoyed by it.
Really?
So, yeah, we had some good discussions about it. So when you brought up the guitar picks, I was like, oh yeah, okay, I'm ready. Yeah. I'm ready.
Yeah. You're ready. I kind of got to bail right now. Unfortunately, I got to do the other interview that I was sandwiched in and go into Japan mode. But this was really the highlight of my highlight of my day for sure. Getting to chat about this stuff and congratulate you on this cool book.
Oh, thanks! And congratulations on the live album. It's stellar.
Thanks so much. Thanks so much.
Okay, man. Thanks a lot, Marty, for this. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, man. Let's do some more. Stay in touch.
Okay. Thanks, man.
Thanks a lot, Danko. Take care.
Bye.
Bye. I'm always ready. Let's get busy. Burn it down on the ground.